This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Welcome back to Mike and Maurice's Mind Escape. Let us help you escape your mind.
Folks, welcome back to Mike and Maurice's Mind Escape. We have episode number 235 tonight. We are joined by our guest, Sanjana Singh, and she is a philosopher and the host of the podcast, The Naked Dialogue, which you can find on all platforms, Spotify, Apple. I have the links down below. Go check out her website. It's a great podcast. She's had amazing guests. She's had some crossover guests that we've had on the show. And just lots of interesting minds and philosophers and scientists and stuff. So I really recommend her podcast, so go check that out. Before we get started tonight, head on over to our Patreon at patreon.com/mindescapepodcast. For just $2 a month, you'll get exclusive guest episodes and segments. We've got tons of amazing stuff on there. Stuff with Randall Carlson, Rick Strassman, Laird Scranton. There's a bunch of stuff on there, so go check that out. We're also in Discord, so come chat with us on Discord. If you are interested in Mind Escape t-shirt, here's a bunch of different logos that I've and images I've created for our merch store, so go check that out. I have the link down below. Click on our link tree. It's got all of our links on there. And head on over to indrasweb.org. It is live, so sign up for a profile today. Start speculating, hypothesizing, theorizing, and all those amazing things. It is not in the App Store yet. We are working on that. And we are going to do this one more month. We're going to give away these Mind Escape podcast t-shirts. We have larges and mediums left. I'm going to announce the winner from last month on our next episode, which I think might be this weekend or early next week. Anyways, I will announce the winner on the next episode, and we will get that out to you, whoever that may be. Yeah, I think we've covered pretty much everything. Oh, and I want to give everybody a round of thanks to all of our friends, family, everybody that gave us support. We released our trailer for our documentary, and we've got amazing feedback on it. So thank you so much. And we're adding a few more people into the documentary as well. So we're really excited about that. And yeah. I think it's going to be a really interesting take on the subjects. So, but welcome on the show. Thank you so much for coming on. How are you?
I'm doing pretty well. How are you guys doing?
Doing good. So yeah, I told you we would get you on the show. It's been a little bit, but I was on your podcast. So I think I was one of the first 10 guests. And I was honored to be on your show. And then now, looking at all the amazing guests that you have on, I feel even more honored. They're probably like, who's this weirdo in there with all these amazing scientists? So,
no, I'm honored to be on your podcast as well.
Well, we appreciate it. So you're a philosopher. I would call you a philosopher for sure. I see your tweets and your takes on things. And you're also a podcaster. So those are two of our favorite things. What got you into philosophy? When did you get into philosophy, and what got you into philosophy?
So in 2018, I went to Tel Aviv to get my undergraduate degree in liberal arts. And I had like six options, out of which I also chose philosophy as a basic track. And so in 2018, there was an introductory philosophy class, and I was like, wow, this is interesting. They were talking about Immanuel Kant, they were talking about David Hume, Spinoza, all of these essential philosophers, John Locke. And at that time, I was only a little bit interested, but not really. But I think I really, really got into philosophy back in 2020 during the pandemic. I started reading a lot. I started reading a bit about Nietzsche, completely all the knowledge that I could accumulate from Nietzsche. And then Schopenhauer, and then I read some of the German idealist philosophers, and then psychedelics also came into play. What is the philosophy of psychedelics? I mean, if you've got Dr. Hugh on your podcast, Peter Hugh, he had the book called Numenotics, and in that one also he tries to, basically take all of the philosophers who had taken intoxicating substances and created beautiful prose or poetry or written pieces out of it. So yeah, really, it started almost 4 years ago.
Cool. In terms of so that kind of got you in the door, but like where are you at now? Like what are you studying? Who are you reading? Where's your current level of interest at with, the whole philosophy subject?
So currently, I've kind of shifted from philosophy to artificial intelligence because I feel like it is the future and we do need ethics around artificial intelligence, and ethics is a huge component within philosophy. You either can look at Aristotle's Nicomachean ethics, or you can just like look at the ethical value system of Nietzsche. And that got me very much interested into as to how can we create artificial general intelligence, which is something that Oxford philosopher Nick Bostrom talks about in his book called Superintelligence. So I am currently studying artificial intelligence, some coding, computer science, so that I can, create these artificial general intelligent sentience. And by sentience, I don't mean that they're alive, just like sentience in the sense that they're aware. That they have some sort of a consciousness that they can use that to be intelligible. So that's something that I'm moving towards these days.
Awesome. Yeah, I mean, the whole AI thing, we've definitely broached the subject, but we haven't really gone deep. I mean, I'm familiar with a lot of the different aspects of it, but in terms of, yeah, it's something we haven't really talked about a ton. I'd like to talk about it more. I mean, I guess one of the biggest questions would be,
Should we be afraid?
do you think AI will ever arise to the level of consciousness or I don't even want to say intelligence because I think they will be more intelligent. They already kind of are in some regards. Obviously, it's somebody programming them, but do you think that they will become conscious as humans are conscious, or do you think it'll be a different type of consciousness? Or because my personal take is I don't think there's something that you can't recreate within the billions of years of evolution, and the way that biological life has evolved, that I don't think you will be able to replicate, in my opinion, or at least there's, I don't know, it's hard. I guess my take is we make mistakes, but the mistakes we make also lead to different paths that I don't think you'll be able to recreate in AI. I mean, what's your take on that?
So no, that's a brilliant question. I don't think like Anil Seth would agree to this. He would say that you necessarily cannot replicate sentience into an artificially intelligent system. However, if you follow Nick Bostrom's superintelligence, we can like artificial intelligent sentience can surpass human intelligence, but I don't think so. But I don't think they would be conscious. Now, one thing that keeps on puzzling me is that in that Space Odyssey movie of 2001, You know, there's a scene when he's taking a HAL 3000's plugs out, and the system is saying, "Oh, please do not, take my plugs out." So there's some sort of a qualia there within an artificially intelligent system. So it makes you wonder as to if we do get to a position which is artificial general intelligence, would we be able to make them, as intelligible that they have emotional reasoning, that they have emotional capacities to understand, to be effective? And if they are effective, can they be able to sense what the other humans are feeling? Because if they can have phenomenological experience, they have qualia. So if they have qualia, then there it is some sort of a conscious entity. However, I don't think that we can absolutely 100% replicate consciousness into an artificial intelligence system. And if that does happen, it would happen way, way, way in future.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe it's just, I don't know. I mean, you can look at movies like,
Machina.
Ex Machina, and even that other guy's movie. What's it called? Annihilation. There's some weird stuff at the end, especially that alien stuff that happens at the end. It's like, whoa, what's going on? It's almost like, is that AI? Is that a biological alien? Like, what's going on here? But actually, I think, is that the same person that created the show Devs too? I think it is. That show Devs it was on FX. They only did one season, and it's unbelievable. It's about, I'm not going to give it away, but it's about them basically create or coming up with the algorithm for life, like being able to predict anything. Like, there's a causal line, obviously, determinism all the way, kind of a thing, and they can
Yeah, he
predict.
directs Devs.
Yeah, they can predict everything. So if nobody's watched Devs yet, I highly, highly recommend it.
Alex Garland is his name.
Yeah, I guess that person doesn't do sequels or anything, so there's not going to be like a sequel to Ex Machina or Annihilation or
No, it didn't need it,
Devs.
I don't think.
Yeah, no, but that's a super interesting topic, and I think that when I see these people like, you look at, you watch like Lex Fridman, and he has all these computer scientists on, or you watch who's the guy? He's got glasses and kind of like a goofy hat he wears and everything. I don't know, I forget his name, but he's big in the AI community. And you look at all these people, and they're very interesting thinkers. They're very outside the box thinkers. They're very in tune with what consciousness is or could be and things like that. But again, I think some of these people are very optimistic. I just think that there's something so unique about humans that I don't think, even though we want to replicate this thing or whatever it is, I don't know that we will. And I mean, even what's your take on, you had Sarah Walker on, and she's studying abiogenesis and the origins of life, and alien life, and where does life originate, and RNA and all that stuff. What do you think about that in terms of like, do you think life was created here? Do you think it's like a mixture of things? Do you believe in panspermia? Like, where do you lie when it comes to that stuff? Where does your opinions align with when it comes to that?
I had a brilliant conversation with Sarah Walker. I think she's doing a brilliant job, both as a theoretical physicist and astrobiologist. I asked her questions which were so difficult for me to even fathom. But when I think about alien life, and it takes me all the way back to Stephen Hawking and what he said about alien life, whether there could be alien entities out there. And given the current scenario with the UAP, an unidentified aerial phenomena, and also the Pentagon in April of 2020 kind of revealing that there might be some sort of a UAP happening, I think, if we are able to discover what this alien life is, maybe maybe we can, by the very aspect of comparison, right? So let's say I have a human here, some sort of an alien life here, and we're able to understand alien life by understanding humans, and we're able to understand humans by understanding alien life, you know, that there could be a reactionary effect here. Right. And I think it could definitely change the entire game of knowing what the human condition is, but also what the universal sentient condition is. So it's definitely very, very interesting to investigate or do an inquiry into the human condition and origins of life.
Yeah, and she made a great point, which I've mentioned on our panspermia episode that we did a long time ago. So like, even if you believe in panspermia, or I think there's a lot of legitimacy to it, it still doesn't answer where life came from. It just kind of passes it off onto another, you know, it's basically like, that's not our problem, you know, kind of a thing. Because we will never, if life didn't originate here and it came on some sort of asteroid or astral body or cosmic dust or whatever, we would never be able to figure out most likely where it came from. And if we did, it would be a long time, you know, from where we are with space travel and stuff like that. So it just passes the question off on where does it originate. So that's why I don't think a lot of people love the panspermia. You have a lot of ego, obviously, in science, and there's a lot of scientism, and telling somebody that they'll never be able to figure something out, you know, like that, I don't think sits well with too many scientists. That's why they push so hard for abiogenesis or whatever, when I think that panspermia is actually really valid. You know, if you look at meteorites and asteroids, you know, there's meteorites that contain the organic compounds needed to create life and things like that. So I don't know. But so back to the AI mixed with, let's mix this with the origin of life. Do you think that we are going to mix at some point? Like, I know there's a lot of people that's like, oh, we're going to, you know, the Elon Musk, the, Neuralink, or we're going to migrate with technology, but we already kind of are, right? I mean, everybody carries around their cell phone. Everybody's always got this computer in their hand or in their pocket or whatever. So you're always attached to this thing already. What do you think in terms of integrating it even more? Do you think that's something that we're going to do and integrate it into our biology? Or do you think that this is always going to be some external outlet thing?
I think technology and technological advancement is inevitable. So we would become cyborgs at some point, especially given the factor that Elon Musk is coming up with Neuralink. And we're headed towards a reality where virtual reality and augmented reality is increasingly becoming a part of our own real, this world reality. So, you know, one could argue that there's transhumanism, which is a movement which could be coming into place in future. And when it comes to mixing life with our lives, our minds, with technology, I think, you know, we all have double lives. The first life that we have is our, you know, immediate external environment, this life that we have right now, the space, this time. And the second life that we have exists on this virtual space. So we all lead double lives. And what's going to potentially happen in future is that this second life that we're living is going to exponentially increase to a degree that the real life that we're in is only going to be physiologically important. So if I'm, let's say, using a VR headset, you know, and I'm able to go into this other metaverse reality and be able to do all of these brilliant things that I could do with that technology, what happens to the physiology, right, in real time, in real space time? So if we go way into the future with the technological advancements that are happening, one could say that, you know, we'll become cyborgs, but we'll be so immersed in the virtual reality that the actual reality that actually exists in space and time would only be a thing of concern for physiology. So, but also, you know, again, another factor comes up, that we are medically also having advancements. Our longevity is going up and up and up. Like, people are able to live up to 80 years, 90 years. Mm-hmm. And Neuralink is promising a lot of other things as well. So, you know, there's brilliant technological advancements happening. And I think we will increasingly be able to simulate our own reality within the virtual space to an extent that maybe a real reality wouldn't make much more sense anymore, because we already exist. We already exist. We have this Lacanian jouissance, if you may call that, within the virtual reality. So we are immersed into this virtual reality, and it would grasp us.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Now, I don't know. I just think that from an evolutionary standpoint, too, if you think about it, if people really start integrating this into their minds or their brains or their biology, then, and it gives them some sort of advantage, then from an evolution standpoint, you know, everybody's going to have to do it. You have to keep up. It's going to be competitive like everything else in life, right? So
unless you head to the woods, go back.
Yeah. That's if they don't come for the woods and need the wood for something. I mean, I think that like anything else in life, it's going to be competitive. So if people are going to integrate that, then at some point they're going to have an advantage, assuming that all the bugs and the kinks are worked out at that point. But I don't know. It's definitely an interesting conversation to have, because I think that we are making these crazy advancements, you know, and it's exponentially increasing each year, the technology and the advancements and everything, I still think we're really not as close as we think we are to creating something that would pass the Turing test or be indistinguishable from biological life. I think that that's still a ways away. I mean, I don't know. When do you, because was it Ray Kurzweil thinks, was it 2045, the timeline or whatever? So...
I mean, there's a lot of AI pioneers, right? Like, we got Nick Bostrom, we got Ray Kurzweil. A lot of people take inspiration from Isaac Asimov as well. So, you know, we have so many people at hand when it comes to artificial intelligence, Marvin Minsky being one of them too. So, you know, we are computer science, and the way artificial intelligence functions, I think we're headed towards a reality where we will, as I was saying before, be living double lives. Now, it depends as to what kind of ethics we'll have there, because ethics is what is containing our community together. Like, you know, ethics is what I would call collectivistic value system, and morality is what I would call individualistic value system. And so in order for a society to exist, we need an ethical code. We need a communal ethical code. So when we are living these two double lives, when we are living a double life, we do need ethics also in the virtual reality. So that's where the artificial intelligence ethics comes in, and Singularity Project. So it's very interesting to see how things are going there.
What do you think? And I've heard some talk about this, and I thought it was a very interesting topic. Assuming that we do create these AIs that are super advanced and maybe not completely us, but getting there. Would they be able to have something like a psychedelic experience? You know what I'm saying? Like, we have certain things associated with our consciousness that you can only experience through biology. So would there be a possibility? Would they download what it would be like? Or would we have the neurons and the synapses mapped at that point with the 5-HT2A receptors and the playoff of that? Like, would we understand that and integrate that into, or like, you know what I'm saying? Or would that not matter, do you think, to AI? Would that not come into play at all?
So I think if we do come to a place where we're able to have an artificially general intelligent system, the artificially general intelligent system would be able to at least simulate exactly what a psychedelic experience is. And of course, it wouldn't have those affective mechanisms of realizing what this experience is, but they could objectively simulate the experience and see exactly what happens. So the objective side of the psychedelic experience would be present via simulation, but the subjective feelings would be absent because there's no biology in the body.
Absolutely. So in terms of when you look at psychedelics, I know we've talked about, you know, I think when I was on your podcast, we talked about psychedelics and you and I have talked about it a little bit, off air too. What excites you about psychedelics? Like, what is it? The experiences still? Is it the mysteries? You know, is it people talking about the entities? What are the entities? Because I know you're interested in the mind and how the mind works. I know that fascinates me, the entities. But, you know, is there something specifically right now that you are interested in or researching?
So when I was like growing up, I would read these Eleusinian mysteries because my father is very much into theology. So, you know, I was reading all of those things. And years later, when I started to notice, okay, what is psychedelics? Like, I'm just trying to understand. Then I realized that in the Eleusinian mysteries, they were using this potion called Kaikon. Mm-hmm. And this Kaikon was, you know, this potion that could give you a psychedelic experience, a spiritual psychedelic experience. So that's the first thing that came into my mind. And I was like, wow, that's a psychedelic. That's something that people have been using for ages. Same goes with Rig Veda, where, you know, Soma is considered as a psychedelic or, you know, an intoxicating compound. So my interest started with, I would say, history of exactly what psychedelics and where they came from. And then it shifted towards research as to what are the potential benefits. Then whenever I started having my own psychedelic experiences, I try to understand exactly the intrinsic value of it. So, you know how I would say lysergamines give you this geometric, objective kind of hallucinations, which tell you more mysteries about the external environment, while mushrooms, I would say, give you intrinsic value, intrinsic systems, what is going on inside of you. So you go in with the mushrooms and you go out with the lysergamines. Now, I haven't experienced mescaline or DMT yet, but I suppose they also have a good amount of brilliant experience, phenomenologically speaking, you know, within them. But I think my fascination with psychedelics started from history, then went on to research about what are the potential benefits and, you know, cons, and then began my psychedelic journey of actually phenomenologically experiencing them. And I found it to be so, so helpful because I consider it as a medicine, you know. I would do a psychedelic once a year and just like a medicine, you know, go into a trip and have a good phenomenological experience and write down exactly what happened in that experience. And I try to, you know, create prose or poetry out of it because it encapsulates a lot of truth. Of course, you cannot read books on psychedelics because of the hallucinations, but you can listen to lectures. You can listen to Terence McKenna's lectures. You can listen to all sorts of lectures. And while listening to all of these brilliant lectures, you can, you know, make all of these different connections in your head and then write it down. And as you write it down, it's pure creativity. So, you know, it's a brilliant, beautiful trips that I tend to take. And I see a lot of value in psychedelics, especially with healing too. I think it has helped with my anxiety and depression a lot. So I do regard it, highly.
Yeah, that's awesome. You know, in terms of, you mentioned the Eleusinian mysteries, I don't even think people recognize my background is the Telesterion from, Eleusis, which is where things were seen, things were drank, you know, that's where everything went down. The Telesterion is where everything went down during the Eleusinian mysteries. And if that's what you're wondering, that's what my background is. in terms of what you were talking about too, like the Soma and the Homa, obviously you live in India. Is there any sort of consensus of what Soma was? Because we've had a couple we've been doing a What is Soma series. We've only done two episodes. I have a couple more lined up. But we had one person on, Chris Bennett, who's a cannabis historian, and he makes a very, very compelling case for cannabis and edible cannabis as being what, you know, Soma was, and Homa, which is the Avesta version, or the, you know, you had the Indo-Iranian migrations, and, you know, you have the Vedic culture who created the Vedas, as you mentioned, and then you have the people that created Zoroastrianism and Homa, which is their version of Soma. So is there a consensus, though, on what Soma actually was, or is there still debate, or, I mean, what's your take on that?
So I think I would say there's still debate. And also in India, you know, when it comes to psychedelics and marijuana, there's usually a lot of taboo around these subjects. People don't like to discuss it because of how auspicious our religion is and how we would want to, you know, distinctively put our religion here and drugs or psychedelics here. But when it comes to investigating exactly what Soma is, there's several debates. Some people think that it might have been a potion, so it could have been ayahuasca, it could have been a tea brewed. Some people think it's wine, you know, it's made out of grapes. And some other people think that it's mushrooms. So there's a bunch of theories about it, but I'm pretty sure it was a psychedelic. And this is, of course, my own personal opinion because we don't know for sure.
Right.
But I think the way these descriptions are of phenomenological experiences are described within Rig Veda, of taking that Soma potion and what they tend to have a mystical experience out of it, I think... it makes a lot of sense that Soma could have been a very, could have been a psychedelic, maybe even mescaline. Who knows? You know.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I've done a lot of research into it. I don't know. There's not a lot of cacti in that part of the world, and the phenethylamine, you know, experience is a little bit different than obviously the tryptamine or even cannabis. To your point about the ayahuasca analog being Soma, we did have Matthew Clark on, who wrote the book Botanical Ecstasies, and that's his theory, where he talks about Kush grass, which is prevalent in the area, and then all you need is Peganum harmala, which would be the MAO inhibitor, and there's a lot of MAO inhibitors found in nature, same thing with a lot of things found that have dimethyltryptamine. So that would be the case that he makes. That's actually an interesting book, the Botanical Ecstasies one. Also, Chris Bennett, the cannabis, very compelling case. I think he said something cannabism too, or something like that. Some sort of like the etymology of some of the words used and things like that in ancient times come into play. And I know through those migrations too, you get a lot of information based on language and linguistics and things like that. I guess we might not ever know unless somebody can find some sort of papyrus or scrolls or tablets or something, you know. I know that they've found in that region, they've found a couple. There's Russian archaeologists that have found tapestry that shows two people holding a mushroom over a fire. So that's one indication that maybe that's mushrooms. And then you have, again, a lot of evidence for cannabis, the gold and the green descriptions from the Rig Veda, how it was supposedly brought by traders to the region as well. There's like a lot of things that align with it being cannabis, and I guess the origin of Soma and Homa is Su and Hu, and both of those mean to press, like suppressing stalks. So if you're, you know, anybody that's making edibles, you would press the stalks of the cannabis. So yeah, there's different, you know, I guess you could do that with mushrooms though too, but I wouldn't really consider that a stalk. I don't know, very interesting stuff. Sorry if I'm boring everybody with the Soma.
Oh
home
no,
line.
we're riveted, baby.
No, I was just curious your take, because I like to know, like, obviously you live in that area. Like, what are people saying? Do they even talk about it? Is it not a big deal at all? Is it a big deal? Kind of a thing. I like to know, because I think the West is fascinated with these things, but I think people that, like, as you mentioned, live in that area, maybe don't discuss it as much, or it's like taboo, like you mentioned, because of drug laws or prohibition and stuff like that. So
yeah, people don't usually discuss these things here in this country, and it's sad because they're missing out on so many beautiful, you know, compounds that have so many intrinsic values. I would say, you know, you were talking about depictions of psychedelic use in different cultures. It reminded me of how in Scandinavia there's, you know, a lot of depictions of Santa Claus with mushrooms. And, you know, it's considered that maybe, you know, it's an art where you can see the Amanita muscaria kind of mushrooms there. So, you know, you can kind of conclude or take an assertion that, this thing in front of me could have been an Amanita muscaria. That means maybe people were using Amanita muscaria for a really good amount of time. But here in India, we have a huge culture for cannabis in the sense that it's, of course, illegal. But within the northern India, the north part of India, and in the religion of Hinduism, we have this thing called bhang. And this bhang is basically, I would say, either a potion or a smoked cigarette. Now, but mostly it's a potion, and it is prepared by the pundits, the priests, and they take them, and they're the worshippers of Shiva, the Lord Shiva. So most of the priests who worship Lord Shiva tend to engage in bhang, which is their spiritual enlightening phenomenological experience that they get out of cannabis. So that's present here in India. But when you look at the overall picture of exactly what is the condition of psychedelics and psychedelic information here in India, it's quite taboo, unfortunately.
Yeah, I mean, we were dealing with that for a while over here, and obviously a lot of things have been suppressed, especially the cultivation of hemp. Now we're finding all these, well, we knew that there was multiple uses for it, and it's just a shame that we haven't been able to bring that to fruition. So
the other thing is that when you look at, well, you mentioned Amanita, Amanita is a weird one to me because it's not really a traditional psychedelic. I mean, obviously you would decarb the Amanita, so it produces the muscimol, which would be the psychoactive compound that you would want. But it's more of like a deliriant or like a hypnotic, I think is what you would probably classify it as, a hypnotic, probably similar to, what would I compare it to? Maybe Blue Lotus. I've never done Blue Lotus, but I would probably compare it to that for the effects that I've read of people and, all of that. But yeah, it's an interesting one. Makes you wonder, do some people have different experiences than other people, like based on their, you know, biology or gut biome or things like that? I don't know, but I know that that's a very bizarre one in terms of the effects. When you look at, you mentioned there's this culture that, you know, it's illegal there, but people still partake in it. Do you think that, I mean, it's obviously been part of the culture for a long time. I remember just reading an article recently about, you know, the Ellora Caves and how they used hemp as like the to preserve the wall, like hemp, lime, and some other clay mixture, and it's still standing to this day and it's still super preserved. Like, do you think that's been part of your culture for a long time, or do you think that it's been relatively, I mean, we can go back, I think that's like 1500 BC if I'm not mistaken, but like, I mean, how, when you look at it, do you think it's like something that's been a part of your culture forever, or is this somewhat, you know, just in the the beginning of the ancient world or civilization? I mean, what do you, where's your stance on that?
So I think it has been a part of our history for quite some time. You know, I was giving you the example of Shiva. And when it comes to hemp, you know, I was 2 years ago, I was in the northern region of India, and it's called Punjab state. And the city was Pathankot. And in that city, I saw a lot of hemp, you know, plants. And I gathered that people do use hemp a lot in India for, you know, all sorts of reasons. Mm-hmm. However, when it comes to cannabis, I think it's way in the north. So there's another state called Uttarakhand, and another region called Kashmir. And these are the two places where you can get cannabis illegally. But when there's a festival, where there's a festival for the Lord Shiva, you know, you will see a lot of priests coming together and gathering together and partaking in taking bhang, which is the weed potion. So I would say, yes, it has been a part of our history. And given the fact that there's also the mention of Soma in Rig Veda, so I would say, yes, it has been a part of our history as we know it. I don't know. Most researchers try to say that it is psychedelics, but most religious, ultra-Orthodox religious people would say that it is not drugs because they see psychedelics as drugs. And they are not educated much about its potential effects. So yes, it has been a part of our history, but it is still taboo amongst you know, older generations.
Hmm. Very interesting. In terms of when you look at, we talked about the history, and you looked at, is there any sort of like drug reformation happening, or is there some sort of thing happening where they're trying to change the laws, or do you think it's still pretty conservative in that regards?
I think it's still pretty conservative. I think people are using, you know, change.org to petition against legalization of marijuana or decriminalization. But I think it's going to take a good amount of time for India to actually reach that state. However, I know that for cancer patients, and I think only for cancer patients, it's allowed to take THC capsules. A company has been producing that for a while. And of course, it's prescription based. So I think India is going to take some time, a good amount of time, to reach a place where, you know, these things can be legalized.
Hmm. Interesting.
Yeah, we thought it was going to be a lot faster here. Obviously, a lot of the states are making it legal, but still on a federal level, we're still waiting for that day.
I mean, we grew up, though, like where it was like very taboo.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, like, I remember, well, Maurice and I used to talk about all the time, like, this is never going to be legal. Like, we never thought cannabis would be, and now it's recreationally legal where we both live now. So, it's kind of crazy.
The times are a-changing, but still, the federal, yeah. To get that federal push is seeming to take forever.
Yeah, I just, I don't know. It makes you, it makes you appreciate it, you know, all the work that people have put in and all the activism and all the time. And there's people that have served tons of prison time, and there's people that are still in prison for like weed and stuff, you know? So when you look at all that, I have great respect for everybody that's kind of came before us and done their part, as well as we've done our part too. I mean, Maurice and I have kind of always been a part of this kind of cannabis culture and, you know, like the hippie and, you know, jam band scenes and stuff like that. So, but yeah, I mean, it's one of those things where I don't take it for granted. That's for sure. So, so I see you tweet a lot about Plato. I love Plato. He's probably my top philosopher. You were mentioning morals and ethics earlier, and I have this kind of working hypothesis for a while now that like all metaphysics come from psychedelics and altered states of consciousness. Specifically when you look at like Plato and Socrates, I guess they're kind of the same person, but their take on like morals and ethics, it's almost like he came down from the Eleusinian mysteries or a mushroom trip or something and was like, oh, I'm going to get my life in order. These people should be doing this. These people should be doing this. Let's all come together. This is what humanity should be doing kind of a thing. So I don't know if you have a similar take on it, but it just seems like, I mean, you could get there without the psychedelics and everything like that, but it just seems like somebody that just came down from a trip and like wanted to get their shit together and started to write about it or something along those lines.
So no, it's very interesting when I think about trips and how metaphysics comes into play. I mean, yes, you can discover so much more esoteric knowledge, I would say, from psychedelic phenomenological experiences, but just give me a second. Sorry.
No problem. No problem. Yeah, I think that people are probably sick of my take on it. But yeah, that's just...
that's why they're tuned in, man.
No, they're never tuned. They're always tuned in for you.
Let me speak.
Apologies, my dad was knocking. I had to turn him down in the podcast.
No. You're good. No, I just, because I've talked about this a bunch of times, but it's like you mentioned the Eleusinian mysteries, and we could talk all day about that. But you look, Plato participated, Socrates participated, Pythagoras, a lot of the sages and politicians, and even Alcibiades, who profaned the Eleusinian mysteries. I think it was, I don't know, what was it, 403, 405 BC, somewhere around there. At a dinner party. You look at like the history of these, but I think that when I think of, I had a psilocybin experience where it took me through the history of these things, and it showed like Pythagoras, you know, listening, hearing the interval of a blacksmith, or you have, you know, Plato participating in the Eleusinian mysteries, and right there in Eleusis, there's these things called the Plutonian caves, which could easily have been the inspiration behind the allegory of the cave. Imagine Pythagoras and Euclid, seeing geometric shapes as opposed to just trying to perceive them or think about them in their mind, you know, actually being able to see those shapes, that would dramatically alter your perception. So I just look at not necessarily just the Greeks, but you could go all throughout history. And were these people being inspired by these experiences, whether they're just altered states of consciousness, deep prayer, meditation, or psychedelic experiences, or whatever? You know, I don't know. What do you think about something along those lines?
So, I mean, the first subject or the first field of study was, of course, natural philosophy. And out of natural philosophy came all of the hard sciences or humanities. And when it comes to Aristotle or Plato or Socrates, we gather that if they were participating in Chaikon-related cultural festivals, it could have had a subjective influence on them. And they could have maybe accumulated that knowledge and maybe applied that into understanding what this entire universe is all about. So there's no doubt there if they were actually using Chaikon. I would say that, you know, when it comes to understanding metaphysics from an Aristotelian point of view, I think there's a lot to unpack there, because Aristotle's Metaphysics is one of the most hardest book to ever decipher, I would say. Personally, even I have only gone through 50 pages and I was already tripping, I would say that, yes, if they were participating in Chaikon, then it could be. And I think Brian Moresco is this brilliant guy who wrote this book about all of these Eleusinian mysteries and
Yeah,
people
we
that
don't
took
really
psychedelics.
talk. I don't. He. No, I'm not going to get into it, but
He's not a fan.
I don't know if I'd be calling him brilliant. And there was a lot of things taken from other places. I'm not going to get into it, but yeah, there's, some information that came from some other sources that probably should have been referenced and added to the bibliography, things of that nature. So, yeah, I don't know. I don't have a problem with him personally, but I don't, after reading his book and just seeing the hype, there's definitely great research. Obviously, the physical research of, taking these chalices and these different vases and different things and doing chemical analysis on it and finding ergot and different psychoactive compounds. That's awesome. I'm all for that. But then there's a lot of liberties taken, and yeah, then it got into more of the Christianity aspect. I don't know. I just it was it's for somebody that's never done a psychedelic. I don't know how you could write that book, but that's just my opinion on it.
I mean, the reason why I mention him is because,
No, I
he
wasn't trying
wrote.
to despair. I was just pointing that out. I
Well,
don't.
let her finish that statement.
No, the reason I mentioned him was because of the book, of course, The Immortality Key, maybe, that he, does this historical research about how these substances were being used by different cultures back in the day. It goes to say that if, let's say, Aristotle and Plato were engaging in Kaikon, there very well could be that Aristotle's metaphysics was inspired by psychedelics, was inspired by Kaikon. Now, all of this is just an assumption because we don't know for sure. We're just like abstractly thinking about, what could have been, what possibilities are there for such metaphysics to actually be born. And to me, I feel like if even if the Kaikon was an actual thing, then maybe Aristotle's metaphysics, the study of knowledge, the study or quest for knowledge, and beyond, might have been, induced by a psychedelic Kaikonic experience. So you could say that most of the Greek philosophy, if they were, we don't have any proof, of course, but like if we just assert there for a second, we could say that all of these philosophers of Greece were taking these psychedelics and were inspired by them, and henceforth they were writing about it. Because when you take something like a lysergamine, ergot, right? You get these geometrical hallucinations. So maybe Euclidean, geometry could have been born with that. Again, another assertion, just an assumption. And mathematics and other hard sciences could have also been influenced by tryptamines or lysergamines, because of their very structured components. So, it's all assumptions, but I think if Aristotle and Plato and Socrates were taking Kaikon, it very well could be that they could have been influenced by those psychedelic experiences and incorporated it into their own knowledge of what metaphysics is. Now, that's entirely an assumption, hypothetical.
Well, this is the thought experiment I like to throw out there. What in your day-to-day consciousness have you ever experienced that made you feel like how you felt coming down from a psilocybin experience or a trip where it made you want to get your stuff together, be a better person, be a nicer person? And I'm not saying that that's the case for everybody because we know psychedelics act as almost like a non-specific amplifier. So it could work the opposite way for somebody that's in a worse mindset or not a great mindset, as it could work wonders for somebody that has good intentions, that's going in looking for that extra knowledge or that extra, creativity or touch or whatever. So, I guess what I'm saying is what have you ever experienced that would lead you down these insights that these people may have gotten from altered states of consciousness? Like my greatest experiences have come from those experiences. The most metaphysical, mystical stuff I've ever experienced have been in those states. I've never experienced anything really like that. I've had a few weird synchronicities, but I've never had anything like what I've experienced in the altered states or in moments like those. And I don't know if you feel the same way, but that's just my take.
So I would say that I've experienced psychedelic-like states in my day-to-day routine via hypnagogia and hypnopompia. So hypnagogia is this window between sleeping stage and awakening stage. So when I'm in a hypnagogic state, there's a couple of things that's happening. One, which is I see a lot of geometry, something that lysergic minds also do to you, geometric hallucinations. I tend to see a bunch of spiders just, you know, coming across my visual field. That could very well be another hallucination, either by lysergamines. You can compare it to lysergamines or mushrooms. And then I also see these things called Tetris effects. And these Tetris effects are essentially what is your short-term memory and long-term memory. So imagine like your images are just flashing in front of you. So you go all the way back to when you were like 6 years old and having a candy at a store, you know, and you just see that and then you come back and then now you see geometry. So I would say that is the most closest sober psychedelic experience I ever go through on a daily basis. Mm. And I wake up and I feel good about it. It's brilliant. Only a very few researches have been done on that. There was a guy called Andreas Mavromatis who did his PhD research or thesis on it. And there's a academic called George Gillespie. He is on academia.edu. He wrote about how these lattice patterns work within hypnagogia. There's also Sirley Bonham Marcus, who's a teacher, professor at University of Texas, and she's also doing research upon hypnagogia and her own subjective experiences. So I would say, yes, you know, you can have these sober psychedelic experiences and get so much out of it because, you know, when I was talking about the Tetris effects, and you mentioned phenethylamines before, you know, Tetris effects could be compared to 2CB phenethylamine effects, because one of the trips I had with 2CB was that I was going back and reliving the memories and coming back to actual reality. So this is something that happens with Tetris effects within hypnagogia as well. So it's very intriguing to understand, you know, what are these complexities within the sober mind which are able to induce, you know, these hypnagogic or hypnopompic experiences.
So that's interesting you say that. I don't know if this is the same thing, but my buddy Lee Adams, who's been on the show more than a few times, he's studied Jung and all this kind of stuff that we talk about on the show. But he experienced this thing that I've experienced, which is either deep in meditation after about 15 minutes or before you fall asleep, you close your eyes without actually falling asleep and you start to get these lights that like dance around, they flutter. Some kind of look like butterflies or fairies, you know, lights like transforming, changing kind of a thing. Then some of them strobe. But I noticed, I try and follow them around. It just seems kind of weird. I don't know how to explain it. And I don't know if that's a part of hypnagogia or, I think I've asked Rick Strassman. He thought it sounded like, phosphenes, but that would be like something having to do with more visuals. I mean, my eyes are actually closed and I'm seeing all these patterns and stuff like that. When I get into this pre-sleep, sometimes it happens before lucid dreaming, and sometimes it happens deep in meditation. So I don't know if you ever experienced something like that or heard about something like that, but me and my buddy Lee have for sure been going back and forth. We thought we were the only two people, but slowly we're starting to see more people talk about this.
So have you been experiencing hypnagogia specifically or some other kind of
hallucination? What would you explain hypnagogia?
So hypnagogia is a liminal state between wakefulness and sleeping stage. So it's almost like a window. So as I'm sleeping right now, my eyes are closed and I'm about to sleep. So just before really diving into the unconscious sleeping, there's this window, and that is hypnagogia. That is where these visuals come in because you're concentrating on your eyelids. That's what I call hypnagogia.
So
And
that might
hypnagogia.
be it, but I also can experience it not trying to fall asleep during deep meditation too.
Yes, you can. You definitely
Okay.
can. Yeah. So even I had a conversation with Dr. Rick Strassman about it. In fact, he was the first person I contacted, about hypnagogia. One day I was just sitting and smoking some weed, and I went to bed, and I saw these, geometrical hallucinations. At first, I thought was the marijuana laced, but it wasn't laced. It was hypnagogia, and I did some research on it, and I sent an email to MAPS, and they gave me a reference to contact Dr. Rick Strassman, and I contacted him, and I was asking him these questions that if we as a subjective entity are able to see these geometrical patterns, and I also went on Reddit, by the way, just to see, what kind of other subjective experiences people are having with hypnagogia. It seems to me that there are certain objective symbols or certain objective geometry happening within the subjectivity of our own human condition. So I was very fascinated by that. And I was asking Strassman that, what if we put certain people in fMRI machines and see exactly what kind of brain activity is going on in their heads during these hypnagogic experiences, and if they are same across, let's say, 10 subjects, then we would be able to see that there are certain objective symbols in the world. And these objective symbols could be, arithmetic or geometrical in nature. So it's very, very fascinating. And even Dr. Rick Strassman, I remember this email exchange from, I don't know, I guess 2018, 2019, 20 maybe. Even he was like, saying that if I were to be able to be, conducting such experiment, maybe it will lead me to understand what are the objective symbols or what are the objective geometry of the world.
Yeah, that's interesting. I always think too, based on when you have these intense psychedelic experiences or you're in these altered states of consciousness, are you maybe perceiving more than what meets the eye? Like are you seeing more of what's actually there, the nature of reality? Is the pareidolia of your built-in evolutionary mind and brain kind of being disabled and you're allowed to see more of what's going on? That's something I think about a lot. So I don't know the answer to that, but I do know in those states I felt like, it's not just seeing pat like I guess you could use this as an example. So on psilocybin, if you look at a pattern on a wall or a carpet or whatever, it might flow, right? You might do a little wavy action or the patterns might flow into each other. And we know about like superposition and moving molecules and particles and quantum physics and everything like that. Are you experiencing these shifts or these perceptions? Like, are you able to actually sense those things in those states? Or is that just your mind, being kind of fooled by this picture of reality that's going on currently? I don't know. Is that something you ever think about?
So when it comes to hypnagogia and natural state hallucinations, I think it's more visual than anything. I think my prefrontal cortex is very much active during these kind of sober state, psychedelic, almost psychedelic-like hypnagogic experiences. Although I don't necessarily think it has any sensory element to it. Like I don't really feel them. Like there's no affective or sensory inputs there. It's mostly visual, mostly prefrontal cortex kind of experience when it comes to sober hypnagogic experiences. That's the best way I can describe it.
See, I feel like there's a touch of telos or, there's purpose in mine, to my own perception. That could just be my perception of that, but I feel like when I have those experiences, like as you mentioned, symbols and symbolism, there's things that are happening that maybe it's my mind showing me things I want to see, but then maybe it's not. Maybe it's something external that we don't even know about. That's what I think about too. Is it the universe? Is it, I don't even know, you know? But those are the things I think about, you know, because I think there's two ways to look at this thing. We're either, this is a cosmic accident and we're just here and we're all doing our best and, you know, we're all hallucinating, is like a Neil Seth or one of these other scientists would say, or there is some sort of order or purpose or telos. And I tend to fall more in lines with that line of thinking. I just don't think that this is an accident. I don't think that this is, I don't think.
Oh,
I
now
think
you're coming back to our, the good
no,
side.
No, I'm just saying, I think that you could say that, you could say that there's no purpose or purpose is something created by humans or the mind or whatever. But I would say that even evolution shows us purpose. It's trying to survive. Like there is an actual objective thing happening, even with the most fundamental aspect of life. So, you know, why have we been given these tools if, and again, I'm not hypothesizing or speculating on what it exactly is. Is it the universe experiencing itself? Is there God? Is there a simulation creator? Is there, I don't know. But I'm just saying, I feel like there is some sort of purpose or, and it doesn't have to be, again, it doesn't have to be some sort of like religious purpose, but just some purpose in general. I don't know. I have that feeling, at least in my gut.
No, it's definitely very interesting because, you know, all of these psychedelic experiences that teach us so many things. Like I tend to take one psychedelic trip every year. And, you know, how there's a lot of research now coming out of how psychedelics induce creativity. So you see Alex Gray, right? With his brilliant art.
Yeah, amazing.
Amazing stuff. You know, in one of my major high dose experiences of Lysergy Mines, 500 micrograms of Lysergy Mines, I saw what I would call an extended DMT trip. So I had a huge ego loss moment where for what seemed to me like 2 hours could have only been 1 hour because of the time distortion. I saw fractals and patterns and all of these beautiful tunnels and close-eye hallucinations. Even when I would open my eyes, I would see the same things. So it usually makes me wonder, why are all of these subjective entities who are taking these compounds seeing these objective Aztec symbols or Hinduistic entities or, you know, any kind of entities which are culturally rooted? And that's where Jung comes in with his collective unconscious, right? Like with his collective unconscious, he's like, yeah, there's within our deep unconscious is I would say similarity within across all subjective entities that we have the same cultural roots. The culture and society and religion and mythologies are a part of our collective unconscious. And so when we take that and when we try to think about that in a psychedelic perspective, it seems like psychedelics kind of unlock that collective unconscious aspect of what Jung was talking about. That we do get to see this mythical, you know, archetypes, you know, for Aztec symbols, or Egyptian gods or Hindu deities. It's very, very generally interesting. And if everyone is seeing that, then it has to be, it has to be objective. So we see that there's a lot of complexities within subjectivity.
Very interesting.
Interesting.
Let's get to some comments here and hit some of these. Somebody said it's hypnagogia, which, okay, thank you. I kind of knew that, but whatever. Let's see here. Somebody was asking about Brian Moresky's book. Look, I don't have a specific problem with him personally, other than some of the research. And then also he wrote a book on psychedelics and has never done psychedelics. So that's kind of a red flag. I don't know if, you know, you can look at the research he did, the hard science and finding the compounds and the chalices and the the different vases and whatever, and that's amazing. I recommend people read his book. I would just say look into some of these other historians like Chris Bennett, or I mentioned, you know, there's different people you can look into that have done deeper, better research than that book. So I would just point that out. So again, nothing personal. I just think that I know a lot about these topics. So there is a lot of pushback from people in the psychedelic community. So let's see here. As far as those symbols go, you know, you mentioned Jung and the collective unconscious and symbols and symbolism. So do you think then, let's say you can look at his dream analysis and what is it, a man, what does he talk, what book is that where they talk about a man and his symbols, something like that. Anyways, I've always talked about it, but there's a story about he's talking with a mountain climber about his dreams, and the mountain climber has a dream that he dies up on the mountain, you know, alone. So he talks to Jung, and Jung's like, well, maybe don't go up alone or whatever, you know, and he keeps having these like reoccurring dreams. So the next time he goes mountain climbing, he brings somebody with him. I guess there was like a close call or something, but they both made it back. And then for whatever reason, this guy decided to go up again alone, and he actually died up on that mountain. So you could call that maybe like a self-fulfilling prophecy, maybe, or maybe it was in the back of his mind and he was going to make more mistakes. He was going to make more mistakes based on that kind of a thing. But you could also say that maybe the dreams that this person was having actually did mean something in this reality, and maybe he should have listened, kind of a thing. I don't know. What's your take on that?
When it comes to dreaming, it gets complicated because scientifically speaking, dreaming could be an assimilation of your short-term memory and long-term memory images. So, and that's where the symbolism comes in. And Salvador Dali does a brilliant job with his Sergius paintings, kind of depicting exactly what happens in these lucid dreams. And so let's suppose I'm dreaming, and you know, Jung has a brilliant example of him having a dream about a house where he's going all the way down, and then he remembers, oh, this was a house that I used to live in. So symbolism is connected to long-term memory images, while the narrative which is playing within the dream is coming from your short-term memory or something that you've been subconsciously or unconsciously thinking about. Unconsciously in the sense that unconsciously it's present, subconsciously in the sense that subconsciously you've been thinking about it here and there, but it's not really conscious. So you take short-term memory, you take long-term memory being the symbolism, short-term memory being the narrative, and all of it constitutes the dream world. Now, a lot of people talk about simulation theory and whatnot, that we're all in a simulation. But then there's a bat-wet argument, which is that if we are in a simulation, the person who is simulating this simulation should be intelligent enough to make sure that we don't question that we are in a simulation, that we are in a dream world, you know? Right. So it's a fascinating idea to entertain in your head that if I am seeing symbols in my dream and they do have a signification, like Lacan would say, then what does this symbol mean? Why did I have a dream about my teeth falling out, right? Some people say it's anxiety. It's a symbolism for anxiety. So, you know, there's always beautiful, beautiful complexities within dream work and dream analysis. Like Jung talks about it in depth. Like Jung even talked about numerical analysis, in the sense that if someone dreams about certain numbers come in as a symbol, he would just take that and be like, take all of the birth dates of all of his family and see whether the number somehow correlates to that, and if it points to that. So for Jung, it seems like like he would do a dream analysis all throughout all the spheres, not only just including the physiological and the biological and the psychical aspects, but just using all of those three characters all together. Whereas Freud, with his dream analysis, he would say that it's short-term memory and long-term memory. But Jung would go one step further and say that it also has a psychical meaning to it. It also has a mythological, symbolistic kind of essence to it.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. What do you think? When we're talking about dreams and we're talking about, like, is there purpose? Is there, you know, do you find these meaning and symbols and things like that? I personally think that there's more going on than obviously we can perceive. I think anybody would agree that that's the case. But I would go as far as to say that we know very, 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 very little. So the fact that people seem so bold and confident in their theories of everything, or this is all there is, or you're a Richard Dawkins type and you've got it all figured out, or whatever the case may be, I think that we don't know anything. So I think that, you know, with this podcast and podcasts like yours, we're just trying to answer these interesting questions from our perspective and knowledge along the way and things like that. But do you ever think that, like, I don't want to say, like, I don't think about this as, like, a waste of time, but do you ever think that this is almost like a fruitless endeavor? Because, like, this road to gnosis or knowledge or whatever is a very tough road. It's like a brutal road in terms of, like, we will never have the answers. It's almost like it's our job to keep furthering these conversations or pushing this boulder up the mountain for the next person to take over, kind of a thing. I mean, how do you think about that?
I mean, a lot of people would say that studies into consciousness and an inquiry into the objective T truth, capital T truth, we cannot ever achieve it. And people who are trying to do an inquiry into it are basically having a career suicide because we'll never be able to decode as to what, you know, is happening, right. What is the objective truth and what is, you know, the objective reality, the objective truth. But I think, you know, with neuroscience and artificial intelligence and philosophy and psychology, we're trying to assimilate a multidisciplinary system where we can come closer to understanding what the objective truth is. And the tricky part is that, of course, we cannot get the objective truth. Alfred North Whitehead famously said that we know absolutely nothing, and what we know from Western philosophy is just basically Plato's footnotes. So if you really look at objective reality and all of these scientists and philosophers and psychologists and neuroscientists and artificial intelligence people coming together trying to understand consciousness and objective truth, all they're doing is that they're trying to get closer and closer to understanding exactly what this objective truth is, yet not, you know, exactly grasping what this objective truth is. And it all depends on major consensus. Like, if you were to search about what are the famous consciousness theories online, you know, there would come integrated information theory, simulation theory, and other consciousness theories, and you would see that there's always a major consensus upon a certain theory, and that people think is closer to truth. So, you know, you were saying about reality as a hallucination about Anil Seth, right? Let's say a number of people believe that. Then it is closer to getting to decode what qualia is, what consciousness is. But we never really understand what objective truth is. So the quest for a philosopher, for a scientist, is always a journey towards finding what is closer to the objective truth.
Yeah, I don't even know. I mean, I go back and forth, you know, objective truth and free will and determinism. I mean, I think about those regularly. I would say personally, if you look at, like, Laplace and his billiard shot, you could look at the universe like that. So like, if there was a god, or a creator of the simulation or whatever, they would have all the mathematics and geometry and physics. So it would be like a billiard shot. So if you told whatever the top billiards person, you gave them, you know, a neural link or something, and they had all the access to all the mathematics, they could tell you where all the billiard balls are going to land on a break. Okay. So you look at the universe like that. And if there was a creator, they would know, they would have all the knowledge of everything, that's there. So that's the way I look at it. So almost like determinism would be, when I look at like determinism versus free will would be subjective and determinism would be objective based on the human mind. So you think you're experiencing free will and you probably are, but to the universe, you're not. It's just something that's already being played out or already played out. That's just happening, kind of a thing. So I don't know. But in terms of like that, in regard to objective reality, I think objective reality, I don't know if we can know that. There's a scientist, is it Hoffman? I don't know, one of these guys, I think is that's his last name's Hoffman, where he's got an interesting take where it's like, we can't know what objective reality is. Like, we don't have the perception or the tools to know what. So what we have is this like version of reality that's based on evolution and the tools that we needed to get to where we are, kind of a thing. So I don't know, it's an interesting topic, but it's a whole different
that's a whole different can of worms.
Yeah, it's a whole different rabbit hole. But I was gonna say, let's wrap this up, because I wanted to record a Patreon with you, but we'll definitely have you back on in the future, and I will throw this out there that we are adding you into the documentary as well, which I'm very excited about and looking forward to your take on these things for the documentary. And yeah, I mean, is there anything else you want to say before we wrap it up?
No, nothing. I'm just honored to be on your podcast and the documentary. I had a really brilliant, intellectually stimulating conversations with you guys. More looking forward to more of these.
Well, we really appreciate it, and you're super interesting and intelligent, and I love your takes on things, and I love the guests that you have on your show. Everybody should go check out her podcast. It's called The Naked Dialogues, and it's on Spotify, Apple. I have the link to her website and her Twitter handle. She's a great follow on Twitter, so if you're on Twitter and you like joining spaces and constant dialogue and stuff, she's always on there. I love reading her stuff and checking her stuff out. So again, the links are down below, and we are going to record a Patreon with her right now. So if you're interested, head on over to patreon.com/mindescapepodcast. For just $2 a month, you'll get exclusive guest episodes and segments. Thank you to new Patreon member Kevin. And no, it's not Maurice Kevin. And no, it's not Maurice. And Kevin also made a very large donation, so thank you very much, Kevin. We love you and appreciate you and your support.
Yeah, Kevin's are good dudes, you know what I mean?
yeah, we're also on Discord, so come find us on Discord if you want to chat. I'm going to try and still do some Twitter spaces. We did the one for the documentary. We're going to try and do some more. That was fun. We had a lot of people in there. If anybody's interested, you can head on over to our merch store. We have some cool designs. You know, Are We Living, Breathing Magic with Anubis holding the Mindescape logo, the Portara of Naxos, lots of cool designs on there. Oh, of course, Let Maury Speak, hashtag Let Maury Speak. Come on. also head on over to indrasweb.org. It is live. This is a social media platform we created to connect open minds. If you want to speculate, hypothesize, theorize, perfect place to do it. And one more time, we're going to give away one more Mindescape t-shirt. I am picking the winner on the next episode for this shirt. So if you think you'll fit into a large or a medium, all you have to do to enter to win is head on over to Spotify, Apple, or Google and leave a 5-star review, take a screenshot of it, and then send that to mindescapepodcast@gmail.com. That'll enter you to win. Again, I'm going to pick the winner from last month, and we'll let you know who that is on the next episode. One more thing. Next Thursday night at 10 p.m. Eastern time, we have Dr. Gregory Little back on the show. So that should be a fun one, discussing his new book, Origins of the Gods. Yeah, I think that's about it. Again, one more time, please check out The Naked Dialogue. It's a great podcast, and the links are down below. And yeah, we are about to start this Patreon, and we love everybody, and we want you to stay safe out there, and we will catch you next time. Peace.
Peace.
Peace.